I'm back after a little break. I hope you're good. I hope you're really, really well. Today on Lost and Sound, you're about to hear a conversation with a true musical pioneer, Suzanne Ciani. Welcome back to Lost and Sound, back after a little break. I hope you're good. I hope you're well. I'm Paul Hanford. I'm a writer, author, and broadcaster in Berlin, where I'm speaking to you now from on a drizzly Saturday morning in February 2023. And yes, if you're a new listener, Lost and Sound is the podcast where we meet the musical innovators, the outsiders, the mavericks, the artists that do their own unique thing, and we talk about life. And the things that inspire us to make the things that we make. Because great things don't come out of a hierarchy of knowledge. No, they don't. They come out of sharing. Previous guests have included Peaches, Jim O'Rourke, Chili Gonzalez, Leticia Sadier, Ghost Poet, Ghosty Funny Tutti, Nastia, Daniel Avery, Nightmares on Wax, Anne First and more. And today, I feel so lucky to share a conversation with someone who is a true musical pioneer, an absolute pioneer of electronic music, Suzanne Ciani. So, we had this conversation about a week ago or so. She is in California. As you know, I'm in Berlin. And we joined up for an hour or so. Now, in 2023, she is a 5-time Grammy nominee. She's been dubbed the Diva of the Diode and America's first female synth hero. And I'd say one of the first synth heroes, period. And it got me thinking, to be a pioneer at something, I mean, what does that mean? Does it mean the first to do something? And within that, where does that come from? To not accept the status quo, the fabric of what is around beforehand? I think for Suzanne, although she's a classically trained musician, her music is so connected and inseparable from electronic sound and the development of synthesis, foremost the Buchler synthesizer. And when she first came into contact with this instrument and the whole concept of synthesis at Berkeley, California in the late 60s, it was a time of huge social and cultural change. This is California in the end of the 60s. This is the Summer of Love era, the Age of Aquarius. Huge, huge cultural shift. And the synthesizer at the time, her contact with it wasn't like she was picking up an existing instrument and finding new ways to play it. This is about forming the whole language of possibility about what a new piece of technology can do. And she was right there at the beginning, pioneering with it. There's been times in her life since where she's pioneered again, moving to New York in the 70s, setting up concerts in quadraphonic sound. In the late 70s, she also got into advertising, as well as being a musician within the avant-garde. She set up the company Ciani Musica Inc. to produce jingles for advertisements. Her Coca-Cola ad is as ubiquitous. The sound of it, the synthesized sound of a Coke bottle opening in the late 70s that filtered across all of America was as ubiquitous to American TV viewers as Delia Derbyshire's Doctor Who theme was in the UK. And it wasn't until the 80s that she started really getting into a stride of making her own albums. I went back and listened to some of the early ones last week, Seven Waves and The Velocity of Love. And what's really amazing about listening to them as well is that, you know, obviously they still stand up, but again, thinking at the time that so much of these albums has seeped into our lexicon, our language, and our way of understanding electronic music, you know, whether that's ambient or something like synthwave. You know, I'm listening and I was thinking, Stranger Things wouldn't exist without this music. And that's just one example. She's in her mid-70s now and shows no signs of slowing down. So I was just super honored that she was up for having a chat with me, and I'm super happy to share that with you now. This is me, Paul Hanford, chatting with Suzanne Ciani. Definitely, definitely. So you're in California, are you?
Yes, I am. Northern California, outside of San Francisco.
Right, because I can see some of that Californian sunlight coming in through the roof above you there, and it's incredibly different to the minus temperatures that we have here in Berlin. Where, like, if there's like a little bit of sunlight for 5 minutes, everyone just runs out of the building and tries to absorb it in, like we're kind of reverse vampires, I think. And so thank you so much for speaking with me today. Well, I was listening this week again, knowing that I was going to be speaking to you, as revisiting Seven Waves and The Velocity of Love. And it was funny because listening now in my ears, it sort of sounds, particularly in these contemporary times, that there's so many cultural tropes and sounds and artists that have been influenced by this music. But at the time, it kind of feels like perhaps you were creating a language, not just like a kind of music, but a language of music that now is so part of how we experience music. But at the time, I'm not sure that it was. Did it feel at the time like you were treading into new ground? Or was it just more something instinctive that this is the music that you had to make?
Well, no, I was aware that I was treading, as you say, into new ground. And, you know, it just seemed right to me. So part of that rightness, you know, I was aided and abetted by electronic instruments, which could do things, even though, you know, I was trained as a traditional composer and got a master's degree in composition and knew how to write for instruments. But at that very moment in my evolution in graduate school, I met Don Buchla and I discovered electronic instruments. And the compositional, you know, I've always thought of myself as a composer, and the compositional possibilities of that machine, you know, opened up a whole new world. And that was where that new language came from. For one thing, you know, my tempo, if you listen to Seven Waves, it was twice as slow. You know, the tempo was like cut in half.
Mm.
So, you know, some of that music is based on the classical music that I loved. Like the third wave is based on a Chopin piece, but it's half as slow. And the machines could sustain that tempo the way humans couldn't. And also create these big architectural spans of sound that I think, you know, is part of what they call ambient music today. You know, that those big blocks of quiet movement.
It's interesting you say about ambient and a big space, because one of the things I love about your music is the space between the sounds as well, and the way, like, sort of time sort of opens up as well. Do you think that there is there an element of, like, atmosphere that, because to me it feels like sort of like I'm listening to worlds being built in a way, you know, is there like an atmosphere for you that you're externally trying to bring into your music, like maybe from surroundings or something in life?
Well, yes. And I think that comes from the electronic instrumentation as well, because Don Buchla, who was my introduction to all of this, we played in quadraphonic sound. So I played spatially from the beginning. You know, we had four speakers and created what we called illusionary spaces. And we're very conscious of that spatial dynamic. You know, we had a voltage controlled reverb, so you could make the sound come close and far away at whatever tempo you wanted. You could make a rhythm that was based solely on movement. So the movement and the illusionary space of the sound were part, you know, one of the building blocks, just the same way that, you know, pitch and rhythm, you know, were in traditional music.
And it's interesting because I read about that you'd turned down concerts or stepped down from concerts that had been organized in New York, that they weren't able to sort out the extra two speakers for you, the quadraphonic sound. And it feels to me like, what was that a hard decision for you to make, or was it just very apparent that, no, you know, if they can't represent your sound properly, then it's not going to happen?
I was always very stubborn and uncompromising. And I think that stood me well over the years, even though, you know, it created barriers many times. I mean, what I did after that, Lincoln Center was the venue, and it was Avery Fisher Hall. And they were about to rebuild that theater because they had acoustic problems. And I thought, this is perfect, because now they're going to rebuild this theater and I'm going to show them how to do it. Mm. We're going to put in, you know, we're going to make space for electronic music too. And I started a corporation, a nonprofit, and I got all these people on my board from the Audio Engineering Society. And, you know, we couldn't get to first base because it just, you know, culturally, it wasn't time. And even now, 50 years later, is it time? It's still a hodgepodge of, you know, pathways going towards this concept of embracing electronic spatial music. You know, we do have spatial sound now. We have software to achieve this with Atmos and Sony 360 and various, you know, in Germany, you know, you have Monum and you have and they're working in that, and ISM is working in spatial sound. And but the theaters have not yet embraced this as one of their requirements for design. And that's, you know, it's complex because even in traditional theaters, they had a lot of failure in the sonic part of the architecture. So the people that did the acoustics had to work with the architect who did the space. And there were often, you know, there were problems. And you know, it's a collaborative field. And at some point, we have to figure out who the players are who are going to manifest these new spaces. You know, who are those designers, the architects, the sound designers, the, you know, you need a new speaker, you need a new fabric for the walls of the theater. And you don't, you know, it's a tricky thing because you don't want it to, maybe I'm going on too long, but you know, you don't want it to get hokey. And you know, sensational. It's just a fundamental need for electronic music, which is now finding its own. You know, we now have, you know, a critical mass of people actually using these instruments, and they're able to move sound in ways that acoustic sound and instruments cannot.
What do you think the problem is with the people that have the spaces understanding the importance for electronic sound to be communicated in the clearest possible way in these spaces?
Well, I think if you know, go down the layers of, you know, what this is all based on, fundamentally, we still lack the tools that the musician needs while performing. So an instrument, let's just say an instrument is a performance tool. I like to use the Buchla in real-time performance. I have the tools that Don Buchla gave me, and one of those tools is a spatial controller. Those aren't available to everybody. You know, we have two worlds right now. The one I live in is a live interactive spatial control. And then there's another one that's called post-production spatial control. So we do have post-production spatial control, which is complex but doable. And, you know, we have a lot of custom softwares, and Monum has one, and the people in film use their systems. But not, there aren't many, you know, live spatial control systems. And the live systems are what integrates the space, the spatial movement with the music. You know, so you want the movement to be integrated with the sound. You know, it has to be on time. It has to be make sense with the content of the music. I use space. I'm about to do a little demonstration of some of my spatial uses for somebody. And, you know, it depends on the content. If I'm doing the ocean sounds, you know, the space is slow and you know, grand. If it's a percussive thing, the sound might be random and percussive, you know. And so you use different movements.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that. That's brilliant. And I wanted to talk a bit about how you first came into contact, and you mentioned about Don Buchla, in contact with synthesizers, and because you were studying composition at the time. And this was in Berkeley?
Berkeley, not Berkeley on the East Coast. University of California at Berkeley on the West Coast.
Right, at the West Coast, Berkeley. And at the time, could you tell me in a little bit about your situation in your life at the time, like leading up to your connection point with electronic music?
Well, it was an interesting time, as they say, because, you know, I'd come from the East Coast, where I had grown up and went to, you know, an all-women's college, very conservative and strict. And I come out to the West Coast and find myself there at this moment of total upheaval. You know, there were, it was the summer of love had just occurred. We had, you know, we were hippies, there were drugs, there was craziness. And it was a very colorful time to be there. And so that's what happened. I mean, I became a barefoot hippie with long hair down to my waist. And you know, I went to work for Don Buchla, and I just, you know, I had nothing better to do than play with my Buchla all day. And I lived on brown rice and soybeans. And, you know, we had, that's the life we lived.
Did you feel the, at the time, the electronics and what Buchla was doing, and, you know, similarly with like Moog as well, did it feel like it fitted in with you with the kind of the revolts of the cultural upheaval and the hippie movement and your own participation of it? Did it feel like it kind of slotted into place, or was it something completely different?
Well, you know, Buchla was a maverick. He was a nonconformist. His socks never matched. We did not use the word synthesizer. So even though there was now this burgeoning concept of synthesizer, it was all wrong, because it was kind of connoted synthetic music or some kind of keyboard instrument that made interesting sounds. And Don, you know, he was a visionary. I call him the Leonardo da Vinci of electronic music instrument design. And he knew that the fundamental vocabulary of how you talked about these things was going to impact the understanding that people would have. And it was always confronting for him that people didn't understand what he was trying to do. And the other thing is that when you're designing in a technological field, your tools and solutions are always changing because the technology is changing. You know, the Buchla came in at the point that the transistor was available. And all of these, you know, technical evolutionary things which were non-stoppable, right? The IC came in, this and that. And if you're a designer in that field, you're always responding to the capabilities of the, you know, of the parts. And so, you know, I met Buchla at the peak, I think, of his analog design, the 200. And digital, you know, was creeping in at that point. And, you know, I parted company with him really when I moved to New York in 1974. Because, you know, my instrument, well, whatever, you know, it kept breaking and nobody could fix it. I still have that problem. You know, just keeping these things in one piece is still hard. But he went into this long period of design, which was more digital. And you'll see in his, you know, those instruments, a keyboard, you know, because the thinking again was changed by the digital world. But I like to remember him for his work in interfaces. Interfaces are a fundamental part that of instrument building that people are blind to very often. You know, the interface is what the musician touches, how it communicates physically with the instrument. And I think that the interface and the frustration with the interface is what led kids back to analog, because nobody wanted to have to pursue their musical expression by mousing around. They wanted hands-on, interactive, and that's what Buchla was great at.
And is that sense of tactileness, relationship you have with the instrument you're playing, is that very important to you? Do you feel that you've managed to convey that the music that you have done because of the tactile nature?
Yeah, but tactile isn't always just touchy-feely. It's the controls. It's like the switches. It's the control voltages available to you. It's the feedback of the system. What's going on in there? Oh, hey, this one's happening here and that's happening there. I mean, right now I'm looking at this instrument and, you know, the little lights are telling me what's going on inside this thing. And so that's an important part as well.
How important is, we talked about ambient earlier on as well. And one of the things I always like asking musicians, particularly because I speak to a lot of DJs as well, is, and this idea of flow state and this idea of getting to a point with a DJ of like where they lose sense, where everything just kind of comes together and it feels like everyone's in some kind of automatic state, including the surroundings. And I was wondering like what your relationship with flow state is, or it's the kind of feeling where things, you feel molded at one with your surroundings with music.
Yeah, well, it is a form of magic. It just is. You know, especially a performance, you step into that, you know, that 1 hour, whatever it is, that's about how long I play. And, you know, you're like free falling, but you know what you're doing, right? You know, but it's a conversation with the audience, the energy, you know, it's a heightened state of consciousness in a way, you know, where you're doing, you know, I do things in performance that I can't even replicate in my little studio here. It's a different energy system.
Yeah. Like it's like you can rehearse forever, but until you're actually in that surroundings, you know, that there's a certain amount that comes from the energy in a space at a time, isn't there?
Yes, and it takes a lot of energy. That's the other thing. I mean, I'm older now. So, you know, maybe when I was a kid, you know, I had all that excess energy. But now, you know, it's a precious quantity in a way, you know.
Do you find more and more ways to kind of conserve that energy or balance yourself?
Well, you know, I conserve it, you know, before a performance. You know, there are some people who get nervous, not me. I practically go to sleep. My energy state before I play is so, you know, low, right? I'm not wasting any energy before I play. And then I go out and I go into high gear and, you know, with a little chocolate, you know, 100%, 100% if possible.
Amazing, amazing. My yoga teacher always gives a little bit of chocolate out before every lesson as well. And it seems to, she sort of, I was kind of thinking, is that really a yoga type thing to do? But for her, it does work, that sort of calmness, then the energy picking up afterwards.
There's chocolate and chocolate. So, you know, there's chocolate that is, you know, high octane, I call it. But don't eat high milk chocolate. It's not milk chocolate. It's not the sugar stuff. Yeah.
Not the candy bar stuff. No.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there's a place for that, but you know, there's not in this context.
I wanted to plug this chocolate because I
just of course.
Okay. I just discovered it. And I was giving, you know, I was doing this talk at band camp and somebody came up and presented me with this amazing chocolate. It's called, I mean, it's from Canada. And, you know, it's kind of French, so sirène, I would think, or sirène. And it's responsibly, you know, harvested chocolate. This one's from Guatemala. It's 100%.
Amazing. That's amazing. I've got a screenshot. I can do a screenshot and see if I can find it somewhere. Sirène. Yes, I have. I apologize to any French.
Yeah, yeah.
Canadian
French
listeners.
My French is terrible, too.
Yeah.
Here's another 100%. So this is from Uganda. The other one was from Guatemala. But it's just astonishing how, you know, the level of integrity in the production of this chocolate. And you know, for me, chocolate is a kind of it's a medicine. I mean...
Yeah, I have that. I have that with coffee as well.
Yes.
I mean, you have dual citizenship with being Italian as well, don't you? So,
yes.
Do you think that the sort of the heightened sense of quality, understanding quality of food and ingredients, is important to you?
Very, 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 very. Yeah, I mean, all we talk about is food. You know, my communications with my cousins in Italy is all pictures of food. And, you know, that's all we talk about. It's important.
Yeah. I think, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about early life as well and about how music came into your life right at the beginning. You know, or do you have any sort of really formative memories or sensations of early times where music left an impression with you?
Oh, yes. I mean, for me, music was all about emotion. And then, you know, I studied music and I learned the, you know, all the systems that people use, the 12-tone system, the modular system, all kinds of approaches to composition. But for me, the magic was always the power of music to elicit an emotional response. And I thought this was, you know, a very Italian part of me, that it was emotional. I later discovered that there's high emotion in a lot of cultures, in Russia. I recorded an album in Russia. Oh, boy, they know passion. They know passion. I had a huge audience in Spain. And I saw the, you know, the real sensitivity and it was a beautiful thing, you know, to be able to be on a wavelength, you know, with a culture. But I think that music can transcend, you know, all the different types of ways we have of understanding ourselves and our emotions. And, you know, you'll play in Japan and nobody moves, but they're still feeling it. You know, it's just, so, for me, it's about primary, fundamental human emotion. On the other hand, in my regard, you know, I went through this long period of, well, when I moved back from New York, or moved from New York, and I came back to California where I had gone to school, I started to play the piano again. And I was doing very, you would call romantic music. And at a certain point, that disappeared. So I have that music. But what I get from my return to the Bukla is different. It's very freeing in an emotional sense. It's allows me to do so many things. It allows me to be angry, happy, sad. You know, it allows me to just dance in a lot of different ways. So I love that about coming back to the Bukla. And now, you know, now I'm, after 5 years of not playing the piano at all, I'm about to do a concert, a small one, in Mexico with the piano. And I'm not, you know, 100% in it. You know, I miss, it's always right. That way. You know, when you're playing the Bukla, you miss the piano. When you're playing the piano, you miss the Bukla. I don't know.
The grass is always greener.
Right.
Yeah. It must be, do you feel as well that there's sort of, do you think that the moves were tied in with that as well? Do you think in different places, certain that you could be in certain sounds, or certain ways of making music have more resonance?
Well, it just seemed natural to come back to the piano when I moved to California, because I'd been in New York City in a huge studio, surrounded by, you know, lots of people and energy and intensity. And then I came here and I was staring at the ocean and nobody was here. And it was, you know, it was kind of a huge shift in environment. And, you know, I just naturally started to write what was here. So I call them the window pieces. I looked out the window. I wrote the surf, the full moon, the birds, the surfers, the, you know, butterflies, whatever was out there. So yeah, I mean, place, I'm very sensitive to my surroundings.
Yeah. And is that part of the thing about being an artist? And I don't mean that in an excludatory way, you know, of like who is an artist and who isn't. But in terms of like, I'd like to think that we all have a sense of artisticness in us. And it's just some of us sort of have prioritized our lives more towards that, or do it in more of a visible external way. But do you feel that there is a sort of relationship in that context of being an artist with being a bit sensitive as well? You know, I always sometimes feel like art is sort of a way, our artisticness is a sort of way of opening us up to things that might hurt us as well.
Oh yeah, vulnerability, absolutely. But that's a huge topic. I mean, Nietzsche could deal with that. I don't know. I have a sister who's a visual artist. And I so like appreciate her, you know, the functionality of her brain vis-a-vis her art and how it's different from mine. You know, she's tuned to the light and the color and the, you know, I mean, it's just a different, it's the same, it's 100% deep, but it's a different world from mine. And, you know, so I know we're all expansive and all limited and, you know, that we choose. But I do think that there is an artist in all of us, and that's, you know, that's what allows us to even begin to appreciate somebody's work. And that's why I think I can play now the Buchla, because there are so many kids that know what I'm doing now, you know. I mean, I have an audience now, whereas the first time I went out, nobody understood it, and they couldn't hear it. You actually can't hear something if you don't understand it on something. You can hear it, but you're not, you know, if I look at a painting, I'll see one thing. If I look at it with my sister, she's able to lead me into the painting in so many ways that I wasn't able to capture myself, you know?
That's such a beautiful way to put it. And it's really lovely that you sort of, you mentioned about how young people discovering the Buchla and discovering your music and surrounding music kind of is an inspirational force. And on that note, how do you feel about this kind of, you know, because you're now considered, you know, one of the founding modern musicians, really, modern electronic musicians. And is that something is that something that you embrace, or is that something that, you know, you kind of brush off?
Well, you know, I think that it's somewhere in between there. Certainly, I'm grateful for the acknowledgements because it helps me to, you know, communicate the message that I think that I'm here to communicate, you know? And on the other hand, you know, in my life, I was very used to being in the background. And I think I'm the one person that's always introduced as, you may not know who she is, but you've heard her music, you know? And there's always this disclaimer about, you know, and I've been in that space my whole life of, you know, because a lot of the things I did were anonymous. All the electronic music that I did for television, which is heard by millions and millions of people, that there was no attribution for that. It was anonymous music, so people didn't know. And you know, growing up in a world where, you know, as a female composer, you didn't have the doors open. You know, you did once in a while, and that was like so profoundly wonderful that, you know, it was a huge experience, you know, doing a score for a Hollywood feature, but just one, you know, because just one. There, you know, doing the pinball machine, you know, whatever, doing, you know. So I had a lot of firsts in my life, but not, you know, then who knows? There still wasn't an environment of accessibility for women in these areas. So I forget what the question was, actually.
I think it's all about the flow, isn't it, rather than the what the origin of the question was. But, and, you know, what you said there as well about, you know, it reminded me as well of me being English as well, of I grew up knowing Delia Derbyshire's music without any credit to Delia Derbyshire at all, because the Doctor Who theme was just every child in England knew that piece of music in and out, you know, but without it being credited to her, you know, which is sort of horrible. But it's obviously it's great now that she has posthumously got the credit for it. But
Yes, you know, I didn't know who she was. This is another thing. We didn't know each other at all, the women who, of the past, because they were hidden. So, you know, when Finders Keepers put out my, you know, my live Buchla album, I think that they called me the Delia Derbyshire of the Atari generation. I can't remember which album it was. And I said, who is Delia? How do you say it? Derbyshire or Derbyshire?
Oh, I think it depends which part of England you're from. Oh, I say Derbyshire.
Derbyshire.
You're just as right in you know, in your accent to say it how you wish. You know, I mean, I can't speak for her, but that's just in my interpretation of Englishness, which might be wrong.
Derbyshire. Well, yeah, I had never heard of her. And I said, you know, to Andy Votel, I said, you know, who is she? And then I discovered Daphne Oram. And Delia, I mean, these women who were there in the history in a big, big way. So, you know, I'm glad now that, you know, we're starting to get some momentum in our historical understanding.
Yeah. And like, I mean, everyone in America at the same time, everyone in America heard your Coca-Cola. But that was a really interesting point as well, or period perhaps to, you know, in terms that, you know, you're in New York and you set up a commercial company as well. And you know, from being like a music, you know, on the cutting edge of avant-garde to making commercial music, did it feel like this was the same universe to you? You know, what was your reason for setting up the commercial side?
There were lots of reasons. One was money. I needed money. Two was they loved me because the record business didn't want me because it was too different. But advertising embraced different. They wanted something new, you know, new, bigger, better. And so I had this huge play field there. I could do stuff. Nobody knew what I was doing. They didn't understand it. They didn't even, couldn't interfere. So I had a huge amount of freedom to, you know, create what I wanted to do instinctively. You know, I just worked as this instinctive animal, you know, and coming up with stuff that was for me like a poetry of sound. I got paid for it.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. And they paid me well.
No, sorry, please. And they paid you more, yeah, yeah. And I mean, obviously, particularly New York in that period of time as well. You mentioned right at the beginning when we started talking about the suffering as an artist and suddenly getting paid as well. Did you feel like you had had your dues as a suffering artist, like surviving in cold winters in New York by that time?
Exactly. It was so romantic. It was like La Boheme, you know? I mean, yeah. Yeah, I was starving, cold, and miserable, sleeping on floors and struggling. And, you know, all of a sudden, I think, you know, hitting bottom is a very dynamic place. Because if you get to that bottom, I mean, I was even sick. I mean, I was like, and there's no way to go but up. And that is that's a wonderful feeling. And you know, I think it's somewhat of a miracle that opportunities appeared, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I worked hard to get them. I did work hard to get
them.
Yes.
Let's not forget that what people always experience of someone's work is the sort of iceberg effect as well. It's like the little percentage of the iceberg that's above the water compared to the whole life underneath it of working and discovering and, you know, living in, you know, cold places like Berlin or New York. But, you know, so do you reflect, I mean, like, do you listen back to old recordings or are you someone that once you finish something, you finished something?
Well, now I wouldn't have listened back to any of those recordings that Andy released. You know, they were in a vault, just forgotten. Right. And I was busy, you know, my concept of recording and releasing music was based in a very expensive production mode, not the stuff I did in my garage in Berkeley on it or on a cassette, you know, in a performance. Those recordings, like the Buchla Concert 75, I mean, those, it was amazing that there was any document at all because I performed in quad. We couldn't record in quad. Recording wasn't part of my vocabulary then. It was performance. And so, you know, if there was a microphone in the middle of the room recording to a cassette, you know, that's just amazing that happened. And I know one of those concerts was done at a radio station. So that was a little bit more of a responsible recording in stereo. But, you know, it's amazing that there are any documents from that period.
So listening, not even realizing that it was there to be intended to be recorded, did the music surprise you? Did you remember playing the music? Or did you remember the sound of it?
You know, that those live concerts, I had like, you know, an imprint in my brain. I used to have to rehearse for doing those live. It wasn't easy to perform live. I came under Buchla's spell. He said it was a performance instrument. I took that to heart. Before that concert, there's a new one coming out soon that Andy's releasing, which is my first concert in New York, the concert that brought me to New York in 1974. And we found a cassette with that on it. And well, I forgot what I was going to say. But anyway, that concert is coming out soon. Yeah.
Fantastic. And that's kind of quite a nice way to end the interview with a little teaser for a new album or a new reissue coming out soon. So, Suzanne, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Well, it's been lovely speaking with you. And it's really nice to, you know, talk with Berlin in the dark, moody German atmosphere.
Thank you so much. Okay. Okay, so that was Suzanne Ciani chatting with me, Paul Hanford, for Lost and Sound. And we had that conversation on the 9th of February, 2023. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for chatting with me and sharing your thoughts from California, joining California to Berlin there. If you want to explore more about her life, there is the documentary A Life in Waves, which was made, or at least it was released in 2017, and you can find it anywhere to stream, basically. It's well good. I'm sure some of you have seen it already. Thanks to ESO for doing the music that you hear at the beginning and the end of every episode of Lost and Sound. And Lost and Sound is presented and produced by me, Paul Hanford. Just a little reminder, my book, Coming to Berlin, Global Journeys into a Club Culture and Electronic Music Capital, is out now on Velocity Press. And that's it. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you're having a really, really, really lovely day. And I'll chat to you soon.